We have been exploring the questions a journalist would ask if he or she were exploring the story of Jesus, and we come upon the question of when. Now, this is where I must step forward with some carefulness, because in light of the passage that I just read to you a few minutes ago, it's very easy for us to be smug in the presence of such ignorance when it comes to clearly the people who are following Jesus and the people who are just manually attracted to him, because we kind of know the end of the story, and that's cheating. It's like reading the back of the murder mystery before you read the front page and say, I know who killed her. Of course you did. You read the back of the book. That's not how you read a murder mystery, and that's not how you properly get into the story. The proper way to get into the story is that you have to walk the story as it is being walked. And that is where we begin to understand the confusion. The word Messiah is the most loaded term in the history of Israel, because what I think the Messiah is probably not going to be what you think the Messiah is, and we might think that we're actually meaning the same thing by using the same word, but we are not. And using words that everybody assumes has a common understanding causes a great deal of problems. For most people in Israel, the word Messiah, or the Blessed One, or the Chosen One, was a political term. It was a term loaded with history and hope. It was loaded with the hope of David and his descendants being restored to the throne of Israel. And the history would that be that all the great problems and difficulties of empires smacking through Israel, taking away their people, taking them off in exile, bringing them back in exile, ravaging their towns, suppressing their people, making fun of their ways of doing things, putting desecrating objects in their temples, violating their very integrity as people, would be done. And that someone would get their butt kicked the way it should be kicked, all the way across the Mediterranean Ocean. That's what people wanted. Revenge. The holy revenge. The kind that God was supposed to do, but we'll help it along a little. So, Messiah was supposed to be the answer to the ravages of Assyria, the ravages of Babylon, the ravages of Persia, the ravages of Macedonia, the ravages of the Greeks, the ravages of the Romans, and then also finally the ravages of everyone else who made it impossible for the people of God to live in the land that they were supposedly given. And as if you are raised to believe that, and you are raised to understand that that is the only way you can see the come Messiah, then what Jesus was talking about was nonsense. Absolute nonsense. Let me give you an example of this. Many of you have probably never heard of Dr. Charles Drew. Dr. Drew was a remarkable man. He was one of the few African Americans who managed to graduate from a prestigious medical school in the early part of the last century. And his specialty was hematology. Now, back in the old days, hematology was basically a science where we studied the diseases of blood and watched people bleed to death. Okay? Because in order to help people who were bleeding, you had to be able to provide replacement blood for the blood they had lost. And that wasn't possible. So basically what happened to people is that they, rough kicking artery, rough kicking vein, you had a very limited purview in how you could actually help people. You could recycle their blood into the system, but that involved a lot of tubes and needles and getting all this work. And you also had to work very quickly because if they bled, they died. Which is why the famous bullet, whiskey, and a saw was the way to amputate a leg. Okay? Not a big one that most of you want to deal with, but that was the biggest threat. What needed to be done was the idea of being able to create a blood bank. A bank of identified blood that matched the blood of the people here. You all know AB, A, O, and B negative, and all the categories of blood. Well, what Dr. Drew did was he identified the various kinds of blood which had been done beforehand, and he made a process available to preserve blood, to make it possible to store blood, so if it was needed at a later point in time, it could be safely transmitted to the person that needed it. So you didn't have to go through the recycling of blood, or fear blood loss as a threat to the immediate extinction of the person. And Dr. Drew set up blood banks. Unfortunately, Dr. Drew lived in Atlanta. And Dr. Drew was in a car accident. And when he went to the hospital, he was told that he could not go in the hospital because it was white only. And by the time they got him to the next hospital, he had died from blood loss. His own invention could not save him because black people could not be in a white hospital. It contaminated the hospital. Up until the 1960s, black people's blood could not be stored white people's blood because it was inferior. They actually had to have separate blood banks. And white people's blood was not supposed to be used in black people because that was a waste. Are you offended? I am. But see, that's the type of paradigm. And if you're raised with those ways of thinking, it's very hard to break those ways of thinking. And in many ways, we fall back on prejudices. We fall back on poor ways of thinking when the emotions run high and when the stress level gets agonizing. So here we are, almost with the same situation with Jesus. Jesus is coming to them with something new, but it violates everything that they've ever believed in, every way they've ever thought that God actually worked. And of course, their immediate reaction is going to be, no way. That is not how God works. I know how God works, and God hasn't consulted with me first, so therefore, this is not how God works. And if you don't think you've ever behaved that way in front of God, think again. How many of you have even said to yourself, and I have caught myself on a cage, saying, God, if you really wanted to give this advice, this is what you need to do. Okay? And God, of course, does what God always does on those occasions. Laughs hysterically, pats me on the head, and says, go away, boy. Okay? Did I ask your opinion? No. It's not going to stop me from giving it, but I didn't ask for it. So here comes Jesus with something different. The difference is this. And the people who are asking about are not among the people who the kids grew up with. It was the Greeks. Now the Greeks, of course, aren't really included in the chosen people. They are members of the people who are dominating the people of Israel, and therefore are technically, well, more than technically, they are the enemy. So for having them come to Jesus, Jesus' appropriate response should have been, get out of my sight. You are poison. You have destroyed my land, destroyed my heritage, leave. That's not what Jesus did. Jesus said, I am with you for a little bit longer. Walk in the light while you are still able to walk in the light, because it's very hard to find your way in the darkness. Which, by the way, should strike us as the most obvious statement you can possibly make. Anybody who's ever tried to find the bathroom at 3 o'clock in the morning knows how it is to find its way in the darkness, right? How many of you have night lights for that purpose? Okay? How many of you have stubbed your toe on fun things on the way too? Right? You know what I'm talking about. So, obviously Jesus is talking about more important things than that. He's saying, look, I'm trying to show you a new way. I'm trying to show you that my light isn't just for the people of Israel. My light is also for the people of the Gentiles. My light is for anyone who sees it, who needs it, who clings to it, who finds hope in it. That's the moment I come to. Not necessarily to restore the kingdom of Israel, but to restore the relationship and the healing that comes with being in God's kingdom, not the kingdom that we all think we're supposed to be in. A kingdom that has no boundaries. A kingdom that is ruled by no human force. A kingdom that God alone guides, heals, and brings hope. Well, you can understand why that can go over very well. And I don't blame the Jewish people, nor do I blame the Gentiles, because the Jewish people wanted their kingdom restored, and the Gentiles wanted Rome to last forever. And what that statement says to both of those ideas is null and void. Rome is dead. Rome has no power. Which, by the way, is a good enough reason to get yourself killed back then. And the only hope that the people of Israel had was the hope that someone would be put back on the Davidic throne and save them. And you're taking that away from us? That's hard. And Jesus is saying, I'm not with you very much longer. So, you're supposed to ask us to trust in you, and you're going away too. No David, no Rome, no Jesus. Can you say we're screwed? Basically, but then they didn't listen to the rest of the statement, did they? The rest of the statement is, I go away, I come back. I'll be back in a form where you can't lose me. I'll be back in a form where you will never be away from me. That I will come and haunt your life and be present even in the most unexpected places, even in the most unexpected times. Remember I mentioned a few weeks ago that one of the books I had been reading was a book called Jesus Through the Centuries by Jaroslav Pelikan. And one of the purposes behind the book, and one of the things that really fascinated me as I was reading the book, is the idea that because Jesus is no longer confined to a space and a time and an identity and an era, that Jesus can be everywhere and every time in all places and all things, asking, "You want to follow me? I do have a better way." So we have Jesus appearing to the height of monasticism as super monk. We have Jesus during the Middle Ages appearing as the Lord of the Manor who guides us all. We have Jesus during the Enlightenment appearing as the wisest and deepest of knowledge that all men should, people should seek. We have Jesus in the period of colonialization and independence declaring, "I am the one who dies and lives for the freedom of all." We have Jesus in a period of economic success and economic injustice, appearing as the one who sides with the poor and the downtrodden. We have Jesus appears in a world that is multicultural, multi-religious, multi-ethnic, multi-everything, appearing as the human being that can reach all, no matter where they are, no matter who they are, literally a person for all seasons. It's amazing how the resurrected Jesus is so flexible. Part of it is our own wishful thinking. I won't deny that. But part of it is also Jesus uses our wishful thinking and our deepest hopes and dreams as a way to gain entrance into the very core of our being, which is a fancy way of saying that Jesus meets us where we are and addresses the questions that we need to ask. I know there are bumper stickers that say that Jesus is the answer. I don't agree with that. I think Jesus is the question. Because Jesus asks questions. Who do you say I am? Who are you? What do you want from me? What do you need? What are your dreams? What are your hopes? Tell me. Because Jesus' answer to the question of when is always now. No matter when that now is, it's always now. That now never changes. The circumstance changes. The question asked change. The people we are change. But if we really want to find what God is doing now, take a look at what would Jesus do. Amen.